Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you.
Hello and welcome to episode 286 of Dogcast Radio, which is all about Clear Path for Veterans, as well as later on, we'll have the Dogcast Radio news. Detection dogs have been used in the UK to successfully identify tree disease, helping track down the deadly tree pathogen Phytophthora remorum. Clear Path for Veterans helps veterans find community and connections one dog at a time. Their flagship programme trains and pairs veterans with service dogs across the United States of America. Their CEO, Ryan Woodruff, is a Marine Corps veteran who himself received services as he transitioned from military to civilian life.
Clear Path for Veterans has been around for about 15 years now. It all started with a canine program. Back in 2011, our founder, Melissa Spicer, she was running a dog training studio, and a veteran to the local area reached out to her with this idea to start a canine program that placed trained service dogs for veterans diagnosed with post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury. And from there, we developed several other programs to look at the whole person instead of just fixating on one issue. So we really try to identify root causes and find where the veteran is at and then match the right programs with them.
Excellent. It sounds wonderful. We'll sort of get into, I'm really eager to get into the training and talk about all of it. But I mean, first of all, you have a personal knowledge of the benefit of this program, don't you?
I do. So I was a recipient several years ago when I first started. About a decade ago, I was a peer mentor on staff, but as a veteran myself who did a couple tours to Iraq in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom, I had really struggled with my own transition and found this program that was existing at Clear Path that I wasn't directly working for at the time. I was doing something much separately, but I applied and I actually went through that program, and that's where I discovered my affinity for dog training, for working with other veterans to help them find a trained service dog and more independence.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, we ask soldiers that go out to around Iraq, you know, many places around the world, to face dreadful, awful, beyond the imagining of most of us, situations. And that must take an awful toll on you, mustn't it?
Yes, it's hard to describe. At the time that I enlisted was in 2005, and we were really at the height of conflict in the Middle East. And knowing this, I signed up when I was 17 years old. And at the age of 18, I had conducted my first deployment in 2006 to Iraq and in the infantry. So I knew full well that I would be seeing combat. But what you see on TV and in the movies is a far cry from the realities of that. And during my time in my first deployment, having, you know, I was fortunate to have come back, but not all of the brothers I deployed with did come home. Yeah. So we actually lost around 14 service members that I deployed with. Yeah. And those aren't things that you can just easily recover from. It takes a long time. For me, it's taken well over a decade.
Yeah, yeah. The British aren't very good at saying this, but thank you for your service, because that's a huge chunk of your life and quality of life. So, I mean, thank you. I can't imagine what that is like. So, I mean, and it feels awful to ask you these kinds of questions, but how did it affect you when you came? I mean, I imagine that the human psyche is such that when you're in that situation, you kind of hold it together. And then it's when you come back and you try and get back into normal life that, you know, the brain is good at going, right, there's a crisis, hold it together. Okay, we can relax now. Bang. Nothing like yours, but I mean, from my own experience, having my daughter was traumatic and my brain held it together for a while. And then my mum retired and it was like my brain went, right, so there's somebody to look after the baby now. You can fall apart. You know, and that's kind of how the human brain works sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And after doing two deployments in combat and serving 4 years in the Marine Corps, you really start to think about what the other side is like and to embrace some of the freedoms that we signed up to protect. For me, I really had an idea and a vision of what life would look like outside of service. And the thing is that when you experience something to that degree in the formative part of your years, 18 through 22 years old, it's very imprinting. And so it's not something that you just let go of. It becomes part of the fabric of who you are and your being, and it starts to become your identity. And the hardest part about that is when moving from the military culture into the civilian world, it becomes very difficult to connect and find people that have gone through similar experiences. But what I have found is community is just so critically important. And really, that's what brings me to the canine program. A dog and connecting with an animal is much different than trying to find common ground with another human being with different types of experiences. So that was a real good step in the right direction for me. Yeah. And it just took several years, but working through the canine program, both as a recipient, but then as a trainer, and just being immersed into a world of dogs was really a good step towards healing for me.
Yeah, yeah. Dogs, the only way I can put it is dogs have a magic. And they weave their spell on you and calm you down, you know, from a pet dog up to, you know, a highly trained assistance dog, support dog. They're just magic. So tell me about your dog then.
So I have a couple dogs. Right now I have a service dog that lives with me. It's not my service dog. And I also have a Dutch Shepherd, which I'm training for sport in the moment. Unfortunately, the dog that I was placed with within the program lost her life, actually within the first 3 years of me going through that program.
Wow.
But that critical moment for me was really life-changing.
Yeah.
So having one thing I'll say about dogs, for me personally, I think they reveal the best sides of us and the worst sides of us.
Yes.
And so at the time when I was placed with this dog, what I didn't realize was there's a lot of things that I didn't overcome personally throughout my journey. And so this dog, really what I've learned is that dogs are really yourself in the mirror and can be vicariously traumatized just by your own feelings, heightened senses of cortisol, feeling the fight or flight continuously. And so my dog behaviorally she developed some reactivity towards people. She started to be an outward expression of everything I was feeling inside. Mm-hmm. And so what I realized then was if I'm going to be successful in this, I have to deal with some of these things that I'm working through. And that was a critical moment in just understanding and identifying. Well, it took all of these years of therapy and work and not finding any closure and how to overcome some of these challenges. It was a dog that really revealed to me some of the things that I needed to navigate through.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? And do you think that it was the dog that showed that to you, revealed that to you? Do you think the dog was then like a really good motivation to work on that? What I mean is, you know, when you panic and you think, I want to get better, or, you know, whatever the symptom is, the mental health issue is, for yourself, sometimes the motivation is a bit dicey because you can kind of have negative feelings about yourself and do I deserve this and that kind of thing. But if it's affecting your dog, that's a really good motivation to go, actually, no, I need to do something about this. If it's impacting on the dog, I'm going to work on this.
Yes, 100%. And I would say likewise with the family and community as well. You know, for me in particular, I've gone through so many different parts of my life where I had to overcome struggle. And this was just one of those moments. I wouldn't say this is equivalent across the board. I think for some of those that maybe have experienced the same struggles that I was with this particular dog may have not been able to see the positive side of it. But for me, I just really had a vision of what this could become. And it helped me better understand some of the challenges that other veterans are facing and what we could do as a service dog provider to really enhance some of the services we were doing and how we could just take our canine program from what it was. And this was way back in 2016, which isn't way back when you think of it, but it was about 10 years ago. And so really what I started to look at was, what are other programs doing nationally and globally that would indicate towards better success? And that led me towards thinking of bigger organizations like Assistance Dogs International. And we started to pursue accreditation and really look at the dog as the keystone variable. You have to have, in order for a program like ours to be really successful, you have to have the right dog in the right career. And you really have to look at the person you're placing with them and ask yourself, do they need a service dog? And are they ready? Are they ready? Because, you know, readiness is a huge factor that we often forget when it comes to pet placement even.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things for me that was a huge milestone in the journey towards taking this great altruistic, well-intended program from where it was to being a internationally accredited program, placing service dogs across the country now. But it wasn't without challenge for sure.
I imagine. Yeah. Yeah. It's a huge undertaking. I mean, training dogs full stop is, you know, has challenges. But when you're trying to train dogs for such specific and difficult behaviors and situations, and, you know, and I guess sometimes the behavior of the recipient of the dog can be a challenge in itself and seem unusual to the dog, maybe. So, I mean, how do you go about it? What qualities are you looking for in a dog?
That's a great question. So we use a widely used temperament test called the GD-BART. It's actually referred to as the behavior checklist. And so it's a methodical temperament test in which we look at all kinds of different qualities in the dog. Bounce back is huge, just the ability to it's okay to have a startle response. It's really about recovery time and how fast that dog is willing to go back to working mode. We also look at things like, how does the dog respond to novel objects, stimuli, vacuum cleaners, food that's available on a table, and looking at some of the innate qualities that are, you know, before any influence that we've had over them. So we're looking at what nature provided us compared to how we're going to nurture that over time. But it's a great baseline for us to really understand the quality of the dog and then to reassess at a couple different periods to see how that progression is going.
Yeah, yeah. So what sort of age do you like to take the dogs into the program?
8 weeks. We do have a breeding program, which is new as of this year. And really, I always tell people, you know, training can start from before the dog's even born. There's been some studies. I can't quote them specifically, but there's some data out there that suggests that actually working with a pregnant mother dog can help fire off certain neurons within the puppies themselves prior to giving birth. And I think it's just incredible the science that's out there these days that shows aptitude for learning and, you know, success in a program like this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, obviously I don't know about your program, but I've seen some of the guide dogs for the blind here and their breeding program. So much thought goes into it and so much planning, as you say, to start the socialization as early as possible and start the training and, you know, just giving them the best environment. And I think sometimes people think that working dogs and service dogs sort of, oh, poor things, you know, they have to work. But actually, they are cared for so thoroughly, aren't they? They have the best start and they're looked after. They have a wonderful life, don't they?
Absolutely. The career of a service dog, I think, opens up the door for so much more opportunity than that of just a companion animal. I mean, and it's culturally different depending on where you are geographically across the world. But, you know, to take the dog in the general public where the general public is legally allowed to go, I think really sets the handler up for just a really fruitful relationship with their dog. And for a dog that's raised in these environments where going out into public is just another day, I think that really speaks to, you know, the dog's ability to develop the confidence and resilience to navigate some of these challenges that it's part of our very human world.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you know, we see pet dogs going into the stores and pulling their owners all over the place because it's the one or two times a month or a year that they actually go out into public. Mm. So I think it really speaks to giving the dog a new opportunity to be in a fulfilling career and work in partnership with somebody that truly benefits from them mutually.
Yeah, Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So you take the dogs in at 8 weeks. You make sure you've got the right sort of material, raw material, if you like. What happens then once they're in the program?
We do work with volunteer puppy raisers. So folks within our community, because of the constraints we have as a nonprofit, we don't have, you know, 50 staff that are fully dedicated to our canine program specifically. We have about 12 staff in our canine program, but we have 42 dogs in training right now. And so we rely on the community to help raise these service dog prospects, but also incorporate them within their daily routines. So be it a teacher or a banker or a manufacturer, we want these dogs to be immersed in those environments when it's the right time, not prematurely, but so that they start to learn what it is to be in our world and to not view that as such a novel stimuli. Really important, you know, if you were to ask me personally, I think obedience and some of the mechanical type of training that we often find ourselves in is less important for the first year. And it's more important to give that dog a free living experience as much as possible. So when I'm raising puppies, there's boundaries, right? Like I don't bring a puppy home and say, just take on the whole home and let's hope for the best. We want to set the dog up for as much success as possible. But everything from taking the dog out potty and navigating your property, I do that all off leash. And I think it's just really important to give the dog a chance to choose and then be rewarded for the right decisions at the same time. And I think it's great for relationship building as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That good things happen when you make the right decisions and then you reinforce that with whether that's, you know, a food or toy or play or attention, you know, that is such a strong reinforcer for the dog. And as you say, it's great for your relationship with the dog. It just really, really sets them up for success.
Yeah. And, you know, the associative learning early on and how fast these development stages are, we find ourselves in this position to check a lot of boxes within, you know, critical periods of development and all of that, which I think is really important. But it's also just about living with your dog and bringing them into your routine and being okay with less than perfect.
Yeah.
I think it's easy to put the dog within a framework where they have to get it right all the time, which can lead to suppression and, you know, the behaviors that they're performing not being intrinsically as valuable as they could be.
Yeah.
So it's continuous. You know, you always have to ask yourself, what kind of problem is the dog trying to solve right now? And if it's trying to solve the problem through undesirable behavior, then it helps you redirect your attention and think about what can I do differently to really motivate this dog in the moment to do what this job is ultimately going to become. So yeah. It's a long process. We take 18 months for the first stage of training, and with a volunteer in the community, we put them through classes weekly. And once the dog's 18 months old, they come back to us for about 6 months of an intensive training period.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like training for the kind of behaviors they may have to do with their veteran.
That's right.
Yeah.
So first 18 months it's pretty light on obedience, but it's more about getting the dog out into the world and to experience all the things that they're ultimately going to be doing their job in. And for us to continuously evaluate and assess the aptitude for the dog's career, I think that's what I always tell people is, as a professional and an instructor and a trainer, I can't dictate the career for the dog. It's going to reveal itself over time, just like we as human beings. I can't tell my child that you're going to become a doctor. That's what you're going to do. And I'm going to put you into this training program. And it doesn't always work out like that. So really trying to find the right career for the dog is critically important. And while we really only have the one as a service dog, we are looking at doing more in terms of therapy dogs and facility dogs, and even something as simple as an ambassador dog too, which just helps us in outreach and doing demos out with the community. So
yeah.
I just think it's really critical that you just continuously evaluate that over time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a lovely approach to hear, that it's not sort of that we're going to sort of shake these dogs and make them a certain shape, you know, do certain behaviors and cram them into this role, whatever their wish is, we're going to make them do this, to actually take them into account. It's wonderful. So then when you've taken their sort of character into account, is that, does that affect who they're matched with?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And compatibility, I haven't found the science behind compatibility yet, but I always tell people it's not like I can have somebody take a survey online and match them with the specific dog. It really comes down to being in the presence of that animal and for us to watch how things go for a period of time. So it's both ends of the leash too. You know, every dog's made a little bit different, and so are we as human beings. And the veterans coming to the program they're struggling with certain challenges and issues, and you have to have the right dog for that. And furthermore, the specific tasks that we train the dog to do have to align with those challenges that the veteran's facing to mitigate them and to help them overcome some of the issues that they're facing. So everything from when we select the dog and we put them in this training program to the point which we say, yes, they're going to be a service dog, we need to start looking at the veterans that we're identifying that are applying for this program and start to do as best we can to assess who's going to be best matched with this particular dog.
Yeah.
And then training comes and we actually have the veteran and the dog work together. And if there's no compatibility, you have to be ready to pivot. I think that's just something that really is important.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, what kind of problems may the veterans be facing? Because, you know, someone that doesn't know much about the military, you know, you assume that sort of transition out of the military is sort of supported and helped, and, you know, they'll be gently put back, you know, helped back to civilian life. So is that the case? What support is there, and what kind of problems may they be coping with?
That's a great question. So post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury have a large spectrum of comorbidities that include things like anxiety, panic attacks, nightmares, disassociation.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of self-soothing behaviors that we develop over time to cope with that. And when we're looking at the veteran candidate and to see if they're suitable for our program, we need to first identify that they've done something within their primary care team or within their community that shows that they've developed some level of coping strategy, or they've worked towards their own treatment, so that it's not assumed that when they come into the program, the dog's going to fix everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think the tasks are really important, not only to be in compliance with the law, but just because when we bring somebody in and we say, okay, you're struggling with post-traumatic stress, like, how does that actually present itself when you're struggling with a mental health issue? What does that look like? And how can I train this dog to perform a task based on a picture? So it takes a lot of deep understanding and genuine understanding to get to know the other end of the leash and understand from not just the individual going through the program, but interviewing their support system too.
Yeah.
And asking questions. So when you're feeling anxious, what do you do? Or when you're feeling episodic, or like you start to drift into a space that is related to your trauma, do you disassociate? What does that look like?
Yeah.
So that we can take those and form pictures that then using classical conditioning to train the dog to perform a behavior based on those pictures.
Yeah. Yeah. Because a lot of that, the panic attack and the disassociation, things like that, the fear of having that happen to you, you know, am I going to have a panic attack? Am I going to dissociate? You know, it can become a vicious circle, can't it? That you just keep going, you know, it self-fulfills, if you like. But it must be such a wonderful thing to know you've got that support with you, that the dog can come everywhere with you. You know, I'm hoping that maybe just having the dog with you would alleviate some of those symptoms, but knowing that the dog can then help you cope with them, it must be such a wonderful reassurance to the veterans.
I think so. I mean, in my own experience, when I've worked with so many dogs at this point and doing this work, it's less about stopping behavior for the human. You don't really want it to be like a, hey, I'm getting corrected every time I start bouncing my knee up and down, or every time I start twisting my wedding band or put my hands in my face. But it's more of a prompt, and it indicates to the veteran, I just like we do to the dog, I got to do something different to change my environment right now to be grounded. And there's tasks that we train the dog to help with grounding as well. But it's a prompt. It helps the veteran understand that there's a event coming on, there's an episode, and that whatever the situation I am in, it's not to retreat from. I always tell people, like, part of being placed with a service dog is you're going to be the center of attention. Everywhere you go, if you're walking around with a floppy-eared lab or golden retriever, people are going to talk to you and ask you questions. And the dog is likely going to be performing tasks while that's happening. And the more and more you do that, this is what's so great about veterans, because traditionally, I mean, and in my experience, we tend to isolate and not want to go back into the community because we struggle with our own identity and we can't find community.
Yeah.
But through going out in public with a service dog repeatedly to help this dog be successful, it's like exposure therapy. It really does help over time veterans overcome some of these challenges that they once had. And it's not always about just going in public, but really, like, if I'm doing something that prompts the dog to perform a task, and that happens a couple times in a day, that's good information for me to know. And it also helps me rely on some of the other things that I have learned through my treatment, like meditation and breathing exercises and a whole toolbox of different things that we can do to help mitigate that issue from getting worse.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. I can't imagine the support and the security it starts to give these veterans. It's amazing. I know that you want to sort of reach even more veterans in the future, and you're going to expand the campus, and you're going to have cabins as well. Is that right? So tell us about that.
Yeah. So a couple of years ago in 2022, we moved from being a regionally localized program serving veterans in New York State to a national program. And so we cover all of the costs associated with everything within our program. That includes flights, hotels, travel, the dog itself, the training, the dog food, the veterinary care. All that is covered. And we have found that we could do a lot more and increase our impact if we expanded our campus. So right now, Clear Path for Veterans sits on a 78-acre campus with a wonderful, beautiful facility. But from a space perspective, we're still a little constrained. And we're not just doing a canine program. We also offer peer support, an employment program, a wellness program, family support. So many things we're doing in this one tight space. And if you saw it, you'd say it's a pretty big space, but there's a lot going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at this point, we've identified the need to expand our canine program into a dedicated facility on site in which we can raise and train 30 dogs at any given time. And then with the cabins, instead of bringing in veterans from out of state and putting them up into a hotel locally, we think having them on site right where the training's happening every day with their dog is far more impactful.
Yeah.
And it could really help with the experience as well. So that's next for us.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess the thing is, for however many people you're helping, there must be people that you're having to turn down or delay. And that must be very uncomfortable for you, you know. And so you obviously you want to help as many people as you can, don't you?
Yeah, the national standard, and, you know, the data may have changed, but it can be anywhere from 3 to 5 years before some of these programs are able to serve the veterans or the applicants. And that goes for all service dog and assistance dog programs. And for us, you know, we do a little bit of a different model where we offer open enrollment. We do it for certain periods of the year, and we accept the number of applicants that we have dogs within our program. We don't keep waiting list. I think it would be better for the applicant or the recipient to be directed to 2 to 3 other organizations that may have more bandwidth. And so we really do our best for when somebody applies and is accepted to serve them within a year.
Yeah.
And I think that's just really, really important. And the need is so high. I mean, we're still serving veterans that go back as far as the Vietnam era.
Wow.
And, you know, with the conflict winding down or, you know, ceased in the Middle East right now, I believe for the next 50 years or longer, we're still going to be seeing veterans from that post 9/11 era connecting for services and with the need to, you know, perhaps consider a service dog for what's next for them.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I do believe if you ask people to serve, well, their country and their fellow country people, whether that's as a, in, you know, whatever all that is, whether it's as a soldier or as a policeman or a firefighter or whatever, if you ask them to put themselves into these dangerous, and traumatic, situations, you have to then support them with the aftermath that that can bring you. Otherwise, why would where's the motivation for people to do it? Because you've got to face these situations and then the aftermath afterwards. So we really need to support them, don't we?
I think that's the responsibility of us as a community, yeah, to welcome our veterans home, our first responders, and to provide a insulated protective circle around them, yeah, to help them move through this difficult journey. Because what's available to them when they leave the military is very small in scale for what they're going to eventually need.
Yeah. Yeah. It's shocking, isn't it? When you find that out, you're like, no, there must be processes in place. And there's, you know, somehow we must deal with this. We must support them. And okay. But it's not, you know, there's so much need. It's been really, really interesting talking to you. And we could have talked all day, but I've always got one eye on the time. So is there anything that you would like to say that we haven't covered yet?
We would just love to continue to connect with the community at large. We do a lot at ClearPath, but we're always looking for other resources and partnerships to connect veterans and families to. And if there's something that you're doing or offering, or if you're looking to start a service dog program yourself, we would love to talk to you and help you through that process. If you have any questions or want to learn more about ClearPath, please feel free to visit our website and connect with us.
Yeah, absolutely. And tell us the website.
Yep. The website is www.clearpathforvets.org.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Ryan, it's been really interesting and the best of luck. And I really hope that you can get hundreds more dogs going and helping people. It really, it's a wonderful thing you're doing.
Thank you, Julie. It was a pleasure.
Dogs are amazing, aren't they? And so are the wonderful people who train and match them with those in need of support. We have all the links you need to find out more at dogcastradio.com.
You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
Time now for the Dogcast Radio news. Forget romantic partners. 8 in 10 Brits insist their pet is the love of their life. Yet experts claim owners are putting their beloved creatures at risk by not taking them for regular checkups and vaccinations. Researchers surveyed 2,000 UK cat and dog owners and discovered as many as 81% think of their pet as the greatest love of their life, while 41% see their furry friend as their child. However, despite pet owners splashing out £1,400 a year on treats and toys for their beloved animals, experts warn, as a nation, we're not taking care of their health requirements, which include regular checkups and vaccinations. As many as 1 in 10 owners admit they only take their pet for a checkup when they're visibly unwell, while 1 in 6, 13%, have simply lost track of which vaccinations or treatments their pet has had over the years, putting their pets at risk of disease or early death. The study, commissioned by MyPet.com, is backed up by industry figures showing as many as 58% of dogs and 72% of cats in the UK have not been protected with annual vaccinations in the last year and are missing regular veterinary health checks. And with 44% of pet owners admitting that their pet often drinks from muddy puddles, brings home presents like mice and birds, drinks from water bowls in public spaces, and regularly visits doggy daycare, kennels or pet sitters, veterinary experts are urging pet owners to rethink their approach by showing how much they love their pets by prioritising preventative care. Leading veterinarian Dr. James Greenwood explains, "This research confirms what we as vets encounter every day with our patients. Many pets suffer unnecessarily from illnesses that could be easily prevented with a simple annual vaccination. Vaccinations and regular health assessments not only save lives, but can also reduce stress and financial strain for pet owners. Whether pet owners are struggling to understand their options when it comes to vaccinations or are concerned about the cost, I'd always recommend talking to their vet about the treatments on offer as well as the healthcare plans that are available. Rebecca Kesseru, veterinary advisor at the MSD Animal Health, warns of the dangers of falling behind with your pet's vaccinations. Vaccinations are an essential part of keeping our pets healthy. Not only, along with a yearly health check, do they help protect from life-threatening diseases like canine parvovirus and feline panleukopenia, but they can also help owners avoid costly medical treatments in the future. Sometimes people assume pets only need vaccines when they're young, but dog and cat vaccinations do not last a lifetime, so our pets need regular boosters throughout their lives to remain protected. A further 4 in 10 owners admit they have been forced to pay for an unexpected or emergency vet bill costing £970 a time because they delayed or actively avoided taking their pet to the vet due to the cost. Vets, veterinary clinics, websites, family and friends are the main sources of information when it comes to our pet's health, along with other owners and forums. Amid these concerning statistics, experts urge pet owners to act by prioritising preventative care so pets can live longer, healthier lives full of everyday adventures and avoid unnecessary nights in hospital. Join the conversation and help spread awareness by sharing your own pet checkup experiences using hashtag IAmProtected. For more information on pet healthcare, visit uk.mypet.com/vaccinate. More research now about just how much our dogs mean to us. Many people view their dog as a family member, friend or child. But does the relationship with them really resemble these human relationships? Researchers from ELTE Etvos-Lorand University set out to explore the precise role dogs play in human social networks by comparing human-dog relationships with human-human relationships using 13 relationship scales. Their study revealed that the owner-dog relationship can be interpreted as a mix of child and best friend relationships, combining positive aspects of the child relationship with the lack of negative aspects of friendship, blended with a high level of control over the dog. Interestingly, while owners often rate their relationship with their dog as superior to any human bond, the study also found that more support in human relationships correlates with more support in dog-owner bonds, suggesting that dogs complement human relationships rather than compensate for their deficiencies. Our relationship with dogs has evolved dramatically since domestication. Once primarily working animals, dogs have become cherished companions, often considered substitute children in many Western societies. Despite this shift, little is known about the specific social roles dogs fulfil in our network of relationships. Human social networks consist of different partners who offer varying forms of support. For example, romantic partners provide intimacy and aid. Children offer opportunities for nurturing and relationship security, while best friends are sources of low-conflict companionship. The study, recently published in Scientific Reports, examined how dogs compare to these human relationships. Over 700 dog owners rated 13 relationship characteristics regarding their dogs and 4 human partners: their child, romantic partner, closest relative, and best friend. Results showed that owners rated their bond with their dog as the most satisfying, and their dog as their best source of companionship. Owners also felt that their dog loved them the most among all partners. Moreover, similar to children, dogs scored high in nurturing and relationship security and, like best friends, had low levels of antagonism and conflict with their owners. However, there is also a greater power imbalance towards the owner in the relationship with dogs than any human partner. Unlike in human relationships, dog owners maintain full control over their dogs as they make most of the decisions, contributing to the high satisfaction owners report. Compared to humans, the relationship with dogs involves few conflicts and minimal negative interactions. The power asymmetry, having control over a living being, is a fundamental aspect of dog ownership for many, explains senior author Eniko Kubinyi, head of the Department of Ethology at the ELTE and head of the MTA-ELTE Momentum Companion Animal Research Group. The results highlight that dogs occupy a unique place in our social world, offering the emotional closeness of a child, the ease of a best friend, and the predictability of a relationship shaped by human control, revealing why our bonds with them are often so deeply fulfilling. The study also examined how dog and human relationship ratings relate to one another and found that strong human relationships correlated with stronger bonds with dogs. We expected that people with weak human relationships would rely more on their dogs for support, but our results contradict this, says co-author Dorotia Ujvalusi. In our sample, people did not seem to use dogs to compensate for the insufficient support in their human relationships. However, the researchers note that their sample consisted of volunteers who were likely more satisfied with their relationships than the average dog owner. The study may therefore not fully capture the experiences of vulnerable individuals who rely more heavily on their dogs for emotional support. Dogs offer different kinds of emotional and social support depending on the needs of their owner, explains Bourbala Torksan, first author of the study. Some people seek companionship and fun. Others need trust and stability. And some simply enjoy having someone to care for. Instead of placing the dog-owner relationship into the predefined categories traditionally used in such studies like family member or pet, the researchers introduced a new, multidimensional approach that better captures its complexity. This framework not only helps us understand how dogs fit into our social lives, but may also reveal where people turn to dogs to fill emotional gaps and why, for many, the bond runs so deep. It certainly does run deep. And it turns out our dogs are not only good for us, but also our environment. A groundbreaking project is successfully training detection dogs to specifically identify the tree pathogen Phytophthora remorum. In collaboration with the UK's Forest Research, canine-assisted pest eradication successfully trained Ivor, a Cocker Spaniel Labrador Cross, age 6, to identify the highly destructive pathogen. This destructive organism can cause extensive damage and even death to more than 150 plant species, including significant mortality on larch, which are important timber trees. Ivor was trained using a variety of detection training techniques, including initial scent recognition. The first round saw Ivor successfully identify Phytophthora remorum in soil, plant material, and sterile distilled water. Further training phases saw Ivor faced with a number of scenarios which helped reinforce his detection abilities by introducing new working environments. Ivor was then able to build up to distinguishing Phytophthora remorum from the scent of other Phytophthora species often found in the same environments to ensure effectiveness in real-world scenarios. The damage to our trees, woods and forests from pests and diseases is significant, with the rapid increase in movements of goods and people between countries and climate change increasing the risk of spread in recent years, and this is the latest government innovation in the fight to protect our nation's trees and woodlands. The UK's Chief Plant Health Officer, Professor Nicola Spence, said, "This groundbreaking research using detection dogs to identify Phytophthora remorum alongside other innovative approaches to tackle pests and diseases will play a key role in maintaining biosecurity to meet the vision set out in our world-leading plant biosecurity strategy. Climate change and globalisation are increasing the number and the diversity of pests and diseases our nation's trees and plants are exposed to. These new threats can cause significant damage, economic losses, and in many cases, tree death." Dr. Heather Dunn, forest research pathologist at the UK's government's world-leading forest research organisation, said, "The results from the trials have been incredibly encouraging, with a first-time 89% detection rate highlighting the huge potential of dogs in our fight against pests and diseases. Biosecurity is incredibly important, and detection dogs like Ivor are an exciting new method for helping to protect our trees. Detection dogs have previously been used to tackle the outbreak of the Asian longhorn beetle pest in Paddock Wood, Kent, in 2012, where a team of dogs from the Austrian Plant Health Inspectorate successfully helped to detect the beetle. Following the success of the initial trials, Forest Research is now exploring the use of detection dogs to help combat other pests and diseases such as Ips typographus, also known as the 8-toothed spruce bark beetle, fulfilling commitments set out in the GB Plant Biosecurity Strategy." Oh my goodness, I don't think I've ever read a Dogcast Radio news with more difficult words to pronounce that I've had to stop and practice every time. But we've made it to the end of the Dogcast Radio news, and I hope you found it interesting. That's it for now. Until next time, look after yourselves and your dogs. Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. What does a young dog stay in on a camping holiday? A pup-up tent.